It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Purizup, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his 4 decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981. And before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than 7 decades.
After 4 decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking, and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine, but could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban takeover. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is its top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of The Spotlight. We'll have Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute George Zamuela joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be Independent International Affairs Analyst Gilbert Doctorow from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to see you, gentlemen. Now let me ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the US and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen. And most analysts didn't. He did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, and this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Lugansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Lugansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S. And they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at a table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis was proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces. Because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait, and if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
I'm going to ask you a question about that too. Okay, now let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes, I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton the time, you know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia. That they want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, when, you know, Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict, because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, I mean, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is, devastating sanctions in the economic sphere, I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They don't have the analytic skills, the intellectual skills, to deal with Russia as it is today. And the economic sanctions are very severe, but I think Russia expects them to be of short duration, because this conflict will end sooner rather than later. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is how it conducts this war in Ukraine. And for that reason, the Western press has misunderstood totally what's going on day by day, why it's going so slowly, and so forth. The Russian concern is in the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages. Whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron said, thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians. Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country." End of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that. But, you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians and before that, the dehumanization of Serbs was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are, you know, you don't want to use the old German expression "Untermenschen," but you know that's more or less what they think. So that's why, when you think of what Russia is doing today. Basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine. But when they do it, it isn't. And that's in the same thing goes by with all this a lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center. Yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Never once has United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen, and this without any U.N. authorization. It killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, right, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear option, attacks on the central bank of Russia and so forth. They have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure, and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that the BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least $25 billion. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. In the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true, too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus. And the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will, coming across the border from Belarus, and the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course, by implication, Russia, that these people were on the border. And in fact, Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So, yes, there's very much double standards, and exactly, it's, you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is, you know, welcoming migrants from Ukraine, and so that, you know, that might cause him some political problems. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Europeans are doing an awful lot of posturing, this obviously with the migrants, but with a lot of very heated bluster in regard to what they're going to do with the Russians. We're going to take on Putin in Ukraine. Well, the Europeans haven't heard a shot fired in anger, for decades, 75 years. So therefore, the only power capable of fighting Russia is the United States. So it's basically, if they're not going to do any fighting, it's going to have to be the United States. And so far, the U.S. is trying to tamp down this war fever, saying, no, we're not going to be setting up no-fly zones. No, we're not going to get directly involved. So I think the Europeans are behaving in absolutely ridiculous fashion.
Okay. Now, Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising and will continue to revise both strategy and tactics depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine, supervised by the Russians, is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamweli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Doctor in Brussels. Thank you. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former Senator David Perdue knows how to crash a party. When he announced that he would seek the 2022 Republican nomination for governor in Georgia, challenging the incumbent Brian Kemp, he did more than enter a primary race. The article you're about to hear has been written by Matthew Continetti, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the book The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. The article has been published by the New York Times, and it's titled, Will Trump Ruin a Red Wave in 2022? Former Senator David Perdue knows how to crash a party. When he announced that he would seek the 2022 Republican nomination for governor of Georgia, challenging the incumbent Brian Kemp, he did more than enter a primary race. He illustrated the dangers facing the GOP in the coming year. Georgia Republicans are divided over former President Donald Trump and torn between mainstream credibility and the conspiratorial fringe. David Perdue, an ally of Donald Trump, has made these divisions worse. The beneficiary, the Democrat Stacey Abrams. Republicans worry about internal strife and outlandish messages that turn off swing voters because everything else is going their way. The party did well in last month's elections. President Biden's low approval ratings endanger Democrats in Congress, where Republicans must net only 5 seats in the House of Representatives and 1 in the Senate to seize control. Republican strength at the state level gives the party an advantage in drawing new maps of congressional districts, which will amplify their slim lead in the 538 estimate of the congressional generic ballot. Yet history shows how expectations can be thwarted. Republicans have experienced hopeful times before, only to have the moment pass. They believed that disapproval of President Bill Clinton's conduct would expand their majorities in 1998. They ended up losing 5 House seats. They believed that Donald Trump would rally the base to support 2 incumbent senators during runoffs in Georgia last January. But they lost both seats and control of the Senate. Time and again, the biggest obstacle to a red wave hasn't been the Democratic Party. In fact, it's been the Republican Party. Republican victories in the midterms next year are far from preordained. Glenn Youngkin's win in Virginia may be much harder to replicate elsewhere than it looked on election night. Republican leaders continue to fear Donald Trump and his supporters, and they are divided over candidate selection, message and agenda. The result is a unique combination of external strength and internal rot. An enthusiastic and combative Republican Party that, despite its best efforts, may soon acquire power it has done nothing to deserve. It will be hard for the party to appeal to the suburban independents who decide elections. Though, Mr. Youngkin's success suggests a path. He is the first Republican elected governor of Virginia in over a decade because of his emphasis on kitchen table issues like rising prices and school closures. He ignored immigration, encouraged vaccination while opposing government mandates and stayed clear of Donald Trump during the general election. He focused on parental involvement in education and planted himself firmly in the center-right of the political mainstream. When asked about a Trump rally where the Pledge of Allegiance was recited to a flag supposedly connected to the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol, Mr. Youngkin called it weird and wrong. One Republican senator joked in private that Greg Youngkin had figured out how to hold Donald Trump's hand under the table and in the dark. Other candidates won't be as skilled or as lucky as Glenn Youngkin. Republicans lost winnable Senate seats in 2010 and 2012 because of flawed nominees like Sharon Angle in Nevada, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, Todd Akin in Missouri, and Richard Murdoch in Indiana. Past may be prologue if Republicans nominate Donald Trump allies whose record or rhetoric are questionable and extreme. Last month, one Trump-endorsed candidate for Senate, Sean Parnell of Pennsylvania, suspended his campaign after he lost a custody battle against his estranged wife. The Trump-endorsees, Kelly Shibaka of Alaska and Herschel Walker of Georgia, are untested on the campaign trail. In races where Donald Trump hasn't yet endorsed, Blake Masters of Arizona, Eric Greitens of Missouri, and J.D. Vance of Ohio may secure the MAGA base by forfeiting viability in the general election. Donald Trump remains the central figure in the GOP. Party elites try to ignore him as he spends many days fighting Republicans rather than Democrats and plotting his revenge against the 10 Republican House members who voted for his second impeachment. The 7 Republican senators who voted to convict him and the 13 House Republicans who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Donald Trump targets his enemies with primary challenges, calls for audits and decertification of the 2020 presidential results, and howls at Mitch McConnell for not being tough. His imitators within the party are a font of endless infighting and controversy, and they undermine the authority of the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy. Mr. Trump would have it no other way. The former president was content to keep a distance in this year's races for governor. He won't be so quiet next year, especially if he concludes that a successful midterm election is a key step to his restoration to power in 2024. A more visible and vocal Donald Trump has the potential to help Republicans in solid red states, but doom them in purple or blue states. Yet control of the Senate hinges on the results in Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire, states that Donald Trump lost in 2020. Glenn Youngkin showed that a positive message attuned to a middle-class priorities repels Democratic attacks. If Republicans campaign on a unified message that applies conservative principles to inflation, the border, crime, education and healthcare, they might be able to avoid being tagged as the party of extremism, conspiracy theories and loyalty to Donald Trump. Their problem is that they have no such message. Mitch McConnell has reportedly told Senate Republicans that they won't release an agenda before the midterm elections. He's worried that specific proposals are nothing but fodder for Democratic attacks. What should worry him more are rudderless Republican candidates who allow their Democratic opponents to define them negatively, and then, if they still win, take office in January of 2023 with no idea what to do. In an ideal world, more Republicans would think seriously about how best to provide individuals and families with the resources necessary to flourish in today's America. They would spend less time attacking one another and more time offering constructive approaches to inflation and dangerous streets. They would experiment with a ranked choice primary system that played a role in Glenn Youngkin's nomination in Virginia and in the law and order Democrat Eric Adams' win in New York City's mayoral race. Interested Republicans would declare today that Donald Trump won't deter them from seeking the presidency, reminding him that renomination is not guaranteed. But that's not the world that we live in. Republicans appear either unwilling or unable to treat the former president as a figure from the past, whose behavior has done the party more harm than good. They take false comfort in the idea that midterm elections are thermostatic, the inevitable repudiation, climatic in nature, of the governing party. They assume that they will win next year without doing anything of significance. And they may be right.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.